Now, this nice young gentleman sitting next to me is our speaker. And his name is Mr. Thomas Robert Hart. And he is a Holly Hill native, right?
Right.
He's from Holly Hill, so any of you Holly Hill people out there? And I'm just to introduce you, I'm just going to read your little bio that you sent me, if that's okay with you. Dr. Thomas Robert Hart, a Holly Hill, South Carolina native, received his BA in history from Furman University, his MA in history from Clemson University, and his PhD in history from the University of Alabama. He's taught at Furman University, University of Buffalo, Canisius College, did I pronounce that right? Okay. University of North Alabama, and currently teaches history of the South and U.S. environmental history at the University of North Carolina, Wilmington. He has published several articles and book reviews and is currently finishing a book entitled The Santee Cooper Project and Its Impact on the Culture and Environment of the Lowcountry. Dr. Hart is well versed in the history of Eastern Orangeburg County, and his topic for the evening will be German Swiss and the New South in Lower Orangeburg County. We welcome you and look forward to hearing what you have to say. And can I say one thing before he gets up here to the podium? Thank you, Martha Rose Brown, for helping us find Dr. Hart.
Thanks, Pam. Thanks, Martha Rose. Thanks for having me. You know, it's kind of humbling actually being up here. I spent all morning teaching 18-year-olds in Wilmington that don't really know a whole lot of anything, at least
speak
about
into the mic. Okay.
I spent pretty much all morning talking to 18-year-olds that in Wilmington that don't really know a whole lot of anything about history. And so it's a little humbling to sit in front of people that probably know a lot more about history than I do. So I'm thankful to be here. I'm glad to be back home. I tell you, after teaching Southern history in Buffalo for 3 years, it's nice to be doing it in North Carolina and through being 3 hours from home. I think they had snow yesterday anyway, so I'm definitely glad to be back home. I wish, you know, my grandmother was also very excited that I was invited. She was very good friends with Miss Josephine Schuler, so she was delighted that, you know, that I was going to be here.
I'm sorry, I can't hear you.
Okay, I'll speak up a little. This good?
Can you hold the mic?
Just speak in that mic. Right. Okay.
I don't know if it'll reach that cord. It's kind of...
Is that better?
How about that?
That's good.
That's
better?
That's good.
All right. So anyway, glad to be here. I grew up near Holly Hill, actually in a little town of Vance. It's not really even a town. It's sort of a blink of an eye. But spent most of my high school years in Holly Hill. So I was reminded a little while back that, or just a few minutes ago, that, you know, that area hadn't been part of Orangeburg County for, well, I guess it's been about 100 years now, a little over 100 years, but we're very thankful that y'all were, you know, that y'all have us. So anyway, what I teach is Southern history. Last year I specialized or taught several classes, the Old South and the New South, but also in environmental history, which is kind of a new field in a sense, but it's not really new to people that understand history. The environmental history really looks at the landscape and the impact that the environment has on economy, culture, the way of life, really, that develops in any particular region or area. And so I wanted to start talking a little bit about the landscape of Orangeburg County and then sort of move towards the New South, and as I do, focus a little bit more on Lower Orangeburg County. You know, the German Swiss, when they got here in the 1730s and 1740s, had to have been simply, you know, amazed at the landscape. I mean, there were two real things that shaped the landscape of this area. One was the longleaf ecosystem. I mean, the longleaf ecosystem really dominated the Southeast from the lower part of Virginia all the way to Texas. One time there were 90 to perhaps as many as 120 million acres of longleaf. We've got about 5 million now. We've got a few in this area around St. Matthews going up towards Columbia. We've got a lot of them in North Carolina. It's the state tree. But you certainly don't have that many across the South anymore. It takes a lot of fire. It takes a lot of energy. It takes a lot of work. It takes a lot of time to grow longleaf. But that's what almost every traveler, you read the narratives of the people who came through Orangeburg, they all remarked on the longleaf pine forest. Broke it down really into two types of pine forest. One was the pine savanna, and the other was the sandy pine ridges that were so well known in this area around St. Matthews all the way up to the Piedmont. The other, of course, was the swamps. And besides the longleaf pine forest, of course, Orangeburg District and Orangeburg County, a lot of swamps. Border on each side, the old Santee Swamp, where Lake Marion is now, would have formed one boundary. You have a four-hole swamp, of course, running up through the sort of the south center. And then, of course, you've got the Edisto River and the swamps that would have flanked the Edisto River. And smaller swamps, Dean Swamp, Holt Swamp, Cowcastle Swamp, all of those as part of the wetlands of this area. And the wildlife they would have seen. I mean, coming from Europe to North America in the 1740s, wolves, they all basically wrote about wolves howling at night. I think even Sally's History of Orangeburg says the last wolf was finally killed, I think, in the 1840s. So for 100 years, wolves, very much a part of the life of people that lived here. Bears, panthers, continued in existence. There were bears. In fact, I think a bear roamed through Holly Hills tennis course about, I don't know, a couple of months ago. So we still got some bears around here, but certainly they had screams of panthers they talked about. Owls, they had owls in Europe. But certainly all of the early settlers and accounts of the early settlers remarked about particularly the barred owl, the one that was, you know, who cooks for you all. That just dominated the swamps. Carolina parakeets, don't have any of those. They were extinct in 1914. They would have been everywhere. Unfortunately, they had an appetite for crops, and particularly orchards. And they also had this tendency that when one was shot, they would all, instead of fleeing, sort of rally around the dead one, as if happened to him. And then they were netted or clubbed or, then shot. So they were eradicated during the 19th century, but they would have been everywhere. You can imagine this beautiful swampland, longleaf pine ridge through the middle of it, Carolina parakeets, the ivory-billed woodpecker, have been throughout this region. I mean, the last of them were seen in the Singer Tract, Singer Sewing Company Tract down in Louisiana, but the others were right in the Santee Swamp. They would have been all over four holes. The Edisto River, the largest woodpeckers in North America. When you think about the landscape, when you really consider the experience that those German Swiss had, it would have been so informed by that. The heat, the mosquitoes, particularly in the swamp plants. Of course, they believed they weren't getting sick, malaria, from the mosquitoes. They believed it was coming from these swamp gases, so they would all flee. That's why Utah was where it is. Pineville, Somerton, Somerville, Walterboro, lots of places. Orangeburg, having so much sandy soil, was certainly not immune to malaria by any means, but a little bit more of a safe haven than some of the lower-lying areas in this region. They also, of course, had snakes, rattlesnakes, alligators, hurricanes. All of this would have made it a very exotic landscape, but also seemingly a very dangerous landscape for the people that lived here. So it was really a constant struggle, not only to make ends meet economically, but to survive. in this really what was basically a wilderness for the first two or three generations. And so that certainly testifies to the strength, the fortitude, but also the experience that they had. They were also able, of course, to turn the landscape into profits over time. We were just talking about how important the cattle industry was early on. The swamps, the cane brakes, the longleaf pine savannas in this area, of course, great for grazing. And it's from this region, of course, that we get the first cowboys. Not out west, probably talked about this before. The cowboys were early, either workers who, you know, were sent out to catch cows, round them up, or they were African slaves. They were the cowboys. And so that was a major part of the economy. So it was timber, the longleaf pine, of course, very valuable, the heart pine, relatively termite resistant, burns pretty easily, but nevertheless, you know, it provided very sturdy wood. The fur trade for the early settlers, particularly, also a part of the economics. That was one of the ways they turned this wildlife in the swamps into a profit, trading. As far south as Charleston, and even developing a trade with North Carolina over time. Also, of course, there was cotton culture. Cotton, first grown in this area, down on sort of the lower end, the Sinclair family, probably the first in what's now considered Orangeburg County, to grow cotton. They grew a variety. It wasn't really Sea Island cotton, which was was a lot like Egyptian cotton in its feel, very fine fibers, very loose. They grew what was called Santee cotton, but it was very close. And that Santee cotton brought somewhere between 50 and 75 cents a pound early on. And that's, you know, when you consider in the 1930s they were getting about 4 or 5 cents a pound, that's a lot of money. Of course, gradually cotton became part of all of Orangeburg County, spread, you began to get more green seed cotton. Cotton gins were around before Eli Whitney, but certainly he was the one who put the patent on it, made it interchangeable parts. So that transformed the area. But also there were other crops that particularly, you know, often people don't think of. Rice. You know, we tend to think of rice only on the coast. But before they even really developed tidal production of rice, they grew inland rice. In many of the swamps here, people that own land on the wetlands grew rice. They didn't grow it in large quantities like they did on the coast, but certainly they grew it as a staple. Also, they grew indigo. In fact, Orangeburg County, or Orangeburg District, not only did they grow indigo in the colonial era, but even after the subsidy was taken away after the Revolution, the British subsidized the indigo industry very heavily. And after the Revolutionary War, most people got out of the indigo industry. But in Orangeburg County, people continued to grow indigo, grow wild indigo, and particularly in areas where the soil had a very high acidic level, that you couldn't grow other things, indigo would grow very well. And so even when Edmund Ruffin, we'll talk about in a second, came through Orangeburg in the 1840s, he remarked it, you know, just how much indigo was still growing. I found this nice little piece in David Ramsey's History of South Carolina, and along with, he talks about Dr. Jameson. He was making 56 pounds of prime indigo to the acre, sold in Charleston for about a dollar per pound. So you could grow, you know, you could make considerable profit. But he also talks, this is kind of interesting, talking about Orangeburg District. The district affords some valuable orchards, particularly of peaches. This fruit accords well with the sandy soil. Some of the old settled farmers have large orchards of peaches, apples, plums, which produce fruit in good seasons, sufficient for domestic use and a considerable surplus for market. From them are made brandy, cider, and vinegar. So the German Swiss had really diversified their economy in a way that on the coast, where people devoted a lot more land specifically to sea island cotton or specifically to rice in order to reap heavy profits, they were able to diversify in a way you don't really see in many areas of the South. You certainly don't see in the Low Country. Well, of course, with those profits came slaves. Major form of labor in the South during the antebellum era. You don't really have the same large slaveholding in Orangeburg County that you do on the coast either. You do have, if you look at the census, several families who had over 100 slaves here and there. But by and large, you know, Orangeburg District compared to St. John's Berkeley, for instance, or the Colleton District even, particularly the area around Beaufort, relatively small slaveholders. Most farms probably had one family of slaves, maybe two families, or maybe what historians call sort of the middling sort of planter had anywhere from maybe 15 to 25 slaves. And that comes back in an important way at the end of the Civil War. Well, of course, with slaves and with the continued agricultural profits came in the 1830s and the 1840s soil exhaustion. There was really a crisis on the East Coast from Virginia all the way down to South Carolina of soil exhaustion. Virginia saw it first. They, of course, founded 1607, had about a three-generation jump on South Carolina. So they begin to face it, and so you get a lot of the agricultural reformers in the 1820s, the 1830s, actually coming out of Virginia. John Taylor of Caroline was one. Edmund Ruffin was another. But by the end of the 1830s and the 1840s, people in this area are very, very concerned about agriculture. They're seeing less and less return per acre on many of their crops, particularly their cotton, which by that time had become, you know, pretty much a moneymaker. And so what did they do? They also, of course, really saw this in terms of a regional crisis. Abolitionism was growing in the North. The South was coming under a continuous attack for agriculture, for what many people believed was kind of an outmoded system, an economic system of labor. And people were leaving. I mean, this is when you begin to get the opening up of Alabama, of Mississippi, Louisiana, and second, third, fourth sons, they're all going. They're all leaving. And so you look around the Orangeburg District, you look around St. John's Berkeley, and you see all these abandoned farms. And you see people increasingly making less off of the farm, off of the land they had been farming for generations. In South Carolina, they turned to a guy named Edmund Ruffin. Edmund Ruffin was from Virginia. He's most well known for being the person that fired the first shot in the Civil War at Fort Sumter. Historians have kind of speculated that maybe that's not quite true. But anyway, he's always been credited with it, and that's what most people know. He was hired in 1842 and 1843 by South Carolina to do a geological survey. And he spent a lot of time right here. And what he proposed, he believed in crop rotation, he believed in manuring, and certainly the German Swiss had been doing that for years. They had also been using cottonseed as fertilizer. But he believed that you really had to reduce the acidic level in the soil, and the best way to do that was to apply marl. And marl was basically this calcareous sort of, you know, the remains, basically the fossilized calcareous remains of life from, you know, 15,000 years ago to 100 million years ago. And it all lay, of course, in this area all the way down to the coast in these rich deposits. In fact, he said that he found between here and Utah Springs some of the finest marl deposits that he had ever seen in America. He, of course, said world, but he wasn't really a world traveler, so we don't know. But certainly, it was there. And what the people began to do is, well, they didn't. They had slaves that dug for marl out, and they would, of course, apply that. Worked out well. I was going through some old museum records this summer from Charleston, and you would get all these. This is also when natural history was growing, becoming part of intellectual life in America. And so you have all these changes. You know, they're digging through the marls, and they're like, wait, are you finding any great fossils, you know? Because you had all these great fossils. I mean, they really gained not only a remedy for soil exhaustion, but also a vast knowledge of fossilized, you know, life, what life was like when this, of course, was the ocean floor. Well, of course, that doesn't save the South from the Civil War. We could spend hours talking about the Civil War. I'm sure everybody who has a family that is from Orangeburg has Civil War stories. Much of it, of course, was burned in our area. Thankfully, when they hit 176, I don't know whether they ran out of matches. Some people say it was the Masonic distress symbol that saved the old Collier home, saved the old Dancer plantation. But certainly a few of the homes were spared, but a whole lot of them weren't. Out of those ashes, though, without spending too much time on the Civil War, came the New South. When historians talk about the New South, and talk about that era after Reconstruction, about 1877 to about 1929 when the stock market crashed. The Depression's really different. This was an era of prosperity in many parts of the South. Now, it was a phrase, the New South, that was coined by a guy. It was actually developed by a Union officer who was in charge of a newsletter down in Beaufort, but we'll forgive that. Henry Grady was the one that actually, the journalist from Atlanta, who really kind of used the term. What he meant by the New South was not really apologizing for the Civil War. And in fact, this is the year, of course, when the Lost Cause really begins to surface. You get the sons or the Confederate veterans, daughters of the Confederacy, for instance, you begin to see monuments spring up. So it wasn't about, you know, eschewing the Old South, their ancestors, or anything like that. But it was about making a new economy, one based on industry, which you see in the Piedmont region, textiles particularly, but also diversifying agriculture. And this is where I think the German Swiss really come in. The German Swiss had a history of diversified agriculture already, and they were not so heavily invested in slaves like many of the planters on the coast that they could not recover. And so this, I think, is one of the reasons why in the 1880s and the 1890s, you begin to see German Swiss farmers, whether they were Schulers, Danzlers, whether they were Felders, Huttos, Moors, I mean, the list goes on and on, at least, you know, in my neck of the woods, Wanamakers, they were able to recover. And they were able to use their experience, particularly with livestock, to create a diversified economy. What you begin to see, of course, in the South large, is the growth of agricultural journals, Southern Agriculturist, the Southern Planter, Progressive Farmer, particularly in the 20th century. You see the rise of Clemson and the Extension Service. All of that coincides with this kind of rebirth of agriculture. Now, certainly there were people who overly invested in cotton. It's hard not to. That was the form of credit. But I think among the German Swiss, at least, you know, from the families that I've studied, they were better at diversifying. And that history and limited amount of slavery, or at least moderate amount of slavery, helped that. There were two other things, or I guess three other things. One was the turpentine industry. The turpentine industry also brought, I won't say tremendous profits to the people of Orangeburg County, but they certainly subsidized some of the other agricultural, certainly supplied their agricultural income. I mean, turpentine had always been a part of the South system, but really it grows extensively in the 1880s and 1890s. People cutting boxes in the longleaf pine, getting out the resins, not the sap, cut a rid or cut a slash or box, as they called it, in the pine, tries to recover, produces this resin to protect it from insects and other things, and that was what, of course, they would collect. They use it for turpentine. Turpentine, I like to tell my students, was somewhere between what we would say Pepto and duct tape. I mean, you could use it for everything. You had a problem, turpentine. I mean, you could use it for coughs. You could use it as a paint thinner. You could use turpentine for anything, you know, spirits of turpentine. And so, of course, people began to go into these longleaf forests, even before many of them were timbered, and get turpentine, turpentine stills, and supplement their income in that way. But the other two, probably even more so catalyst for prosperity in this area, was the railroad, of course, really the major factor in the New South. The railroad really creates many of the towns of the New South. Where I'm from, of course, Holly Hill, founded 1 year after the railroad comes through the little village. Ellery, Cameron, all of those towns, and of course many more in Orangeburg County, really grow up around the railroad. After the railroad, of course, and really complementing the railroad, was the Good Roads Movement, the farm-to-market roads, the improvement of roads for farmers with trucks, the rise of automobiles, for instance, in the 1920s. I mean, these become really the major factors. And it, you know, it sounds relatively mundane talking about railroads and roads, but when you consider that these folks would have either had to float their goods to market or haul them in wagons, I mean, this was a significant advancement. And so it's no reason that particularly, as I've moved closer to Lower Orangeburg County, that you begin to see, of course, these homes now emerging on the landscape of 176, Highway 210, the area around, particularly Providence. I mean, this is the area of Orangeburg County that really shows a lot of prosperity promise. It becomes kind of the future of Lower Orangeburg County in many ways. Get the old Wanamaker House built in 1897, the old Schuller home built in the 1880s, I'm pretty sure. You have some older homes, the Dantzler home built before the Civil War, but you also get, you know, the Moore home. You get a number of these homes emerging that really reflect kind of a new society emerging, a prosperous one, a diversified one. It's really a new South, and one that, of course, would, you know, come to a halt, at least temporarily, during 1930s. But for our ancestors, the Felders, the Dantzlers, etc., you know, the German-Swiss families, this was an era in which they really kind of came into their own. And I think all of those factors really converge. I'll end with just one example. You know, I'm not a professional genealogist, I'm a historian, you know, sort of the, more of an abstract sense, I suppose. But we all like family history, and I thought I'd end with one, my great-great-great-grandfather, Frederick Connor, who had an Irish last name, but his mother was a Schuller. And he had a lot of German-Swiss blood in him. And in fact, I like to think he really thought more like his mother than he did his father. He had a German-Swiss heritage, and as well as anybody in Lower Orangeburg County, he was able to tap into this resurgence of the South between the 1870s and the 1920s. He was born in the Providence section, wasn't a particularly wealthy, he's sort of a small farmer, his father was. Frederick was able, even before the Civil War, to purchase his own little farm, but primarily he made his money as an overseer to French Huguenot families, the Perchets and the Gilliards, that so dominated that area from Eutaville down. I mean, this is the area where you really get this kind of convergence of the French Huguenots and the German Swiss, and a little bit of English and Irish thrown in there as well. Well, during the war, some of these folks go off to fight. He's in his 30s. He actually joins the Edisto Rifles. He's deployed down around the coast about 1862. And then they send him home. This is when they became really intensely worried about production of cotton. They're clear now that the war is going to last for a while. After Bull Run, or Manassas, I should say, you know, they think, well, we'll just wrap this thing up in a couple of months. But by 1862, they realize it's not going to go quite that way. And production on farms and plantations becomes increasingly vital. And so he goes back. He's also older. He's got a problem with his knee. And so that factors into it as well. But he's able to keep these plantations in the area running during the war until it's over. When it's over, he begins to diversify his economy, just like other German Swiss families were doing in the area. He actually built, with the help of one of his overseers, Mr. Dollison, this sort of primitive tram back into the woods. In fact, if you've ever been to Sweatland's, his plantation was right there. It was on that curve where all the live oaks are. In fact, the old overseer's house is where Sweatman's is. It's always a good landmark when you're trying to discuss things in Lower Orangeburg County.
Sweatman barbecue.
Exactly. So he began to build this tramway. So he started making money off of timber, but also on turpentine. He tapped in to the swamps, Four-Hole Swamp, down in Dean Swamp. He would basically pay landowners to allow him to go in and tap these pines. And then he would send out, they weren't slaves now, of course, sharecroppers, tenants, laborers, who would go out and farm these. And he had, of course, Schulers that helped him oversee this project. In fact, what, four or five of his daughters all married Danzlers, Schulers. They all went back to the German Swiss. You know, enough of the Irish. And he made a steady profit off of that. He also built a sawmill. He built a grist mill. I'm trying to think of what else. He also bred livestock. You know, there was this rich tradition in this area of breeding livestock, from cattle as well as horses. What he would do is he would often buy blind mares on the cheap. And he had an old donkey, and he would breed the donkey with the blind mares, and they would not pass down into the mules that blindness. And so he was able to buy these blind mares on the cheap and turn it into some of the best mules in Orangeburg County. He also was able, he would work with horses, he would actually take them out into ponds and take them out into the river and make them swim, particularly these horses that they had sort of a problem, almost like hip dysplasia. And he would strengthen the horses by taking them out in the river and sort of leading them against the river flow, and was able to, you know, rehabilitate them that way. But the fact of the matter was that, of course, he diversified. In 1886, they built a railroad. It came right through his farm. He had the idea that they wouldn't run it on Sunday. He said, you can only run it through here. You don't operate it on Sunday. And that lasted, I think, about 20 years. And then, that sort of went by the wayside. But nevertheless, the railroad became integral to his success. Connecting, of course, this was the first with the Southern Railroad. This went out advanced, and it actually crossed Santee River. Eventually that bridge fell in the water, had to be rebuilt. But it went across and connected with Cameron. That was before the railroad actually then later on was connected to Ellery, Creston, and sort of went northwest instead of north. But very instrumental, and of course, you know, the good roads movement. Though he was dead before he got to see a lot of the pavement on 453 and on 176, certainly his ancestors derived great benefit from that. Well, there's Frederick Connor, there's the German Swiss. The 1930s things changed. There's the Depression. If you weren't through the Depression, you probably have parents or grandparents that were in the Depression. So I need not tell anybody about that. But there were a couple of other things that really began to change the area. This is kind of where I, you know, end. One was the Santee Cooper Project. Santee Cooper Project significantly altered the landscape in some ways for the better, in some ways for the worse, depending on who you ask. It was a very complex project, politically, economically, culturally, but it significantly changed, of course, lower Orangeburg County. And then there were the interstates. I-26, 95, of course, 301, early on, talk about the development of roads. 301 had a major impact on this area all the way through Manning. Read the old letters before it even got to Manning. You read the newspaper reports, and they're so excited that 301 is going to come through Manning. They can hardly contain it. They have parades. They have the marching band. Here comes 301, and they're very excited about it. You know, it made a big difference. But then, of course, you get the construction of I-26 and I-95, and that really alters things. You know, a lot of these towns, of course, places like Bowman, places like Ellery, places like Holly Hill, they're not on the main path anymore. Nobody wants to stop. You know, you don't want to get it unless you go to Sweatman's. You know, people bypass it, and it really begins to bring in a lot of change that, you know, looking around, probably people are much more familiar with in their own lives than I need to tell you. But certainly, I'll end it by saying, I think the German Swiss, you know, the South Carolina was such a melting pot in the colonial antebellum era. You've got the Dutch, you've got the Welsh, you've got the Scot-Irish in the backcountry, you've got the French Huguenots, and of course, you've got the German Swiss, center of it all. But you know, it's quite a story, and I consider this really not at all sort of a final word on the doors, but my first kind of foray into the German Swiss. I mean, I look forward to, you know, being a part of the German Swiss, you know, meeting everybody, becoming more involved with the organization over the next several years now that I'm at least 3 hours away. But I think it's a rich and interesting history, you know, and it's one in which diversity and really ingenuity plays a tremendous role, as does, of course, the landscape. So I'll end it on that note, but hopefully we can continue this conversation, you know, later, tomorrow, the upcoming years, because, you know, there's a lot of stories to be told and a rich, very complex narrative. So thanks a lot.
Thank you very much for a very interesting talk. I know I got a lot out of it. And I guess on that note, that's the end of the evening. Everybody have a safe trip home, and we'll see you tomorrow.